Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Welcome to Hieros Gamos Radio, broadcasting out of the Lower Triangle, Tasmania, the descending tongue of grace, adrift in the freezing waters of Mem, between mainland Australia and Antarctica, howling like the hanged man in a Wi-Fi dead spot. Our guest is an initiate of the OTO, aspirant to the AA, academic and historian, the author of One Truth and One Spirit, Aleister Crowley's Spiritual Legacy, Keith Reddy.
Well, I'd like to start with welcome to the show. And how did you come to be involved with the OTO and the AA?
It's a bit of a little bit of a story. I guess my introduction to Aleister Crowley and the writings of Aleister Crowley happened in my teenage years through a friend of mine at the time. We both met at the age of about 15 or 16, and he was already well studied in Crowley. So he introduced me to it, and it would be several years, at least a decade, until I actually started my path in the OTO. But we would have a lot of talks in between that period of time, and he would encourage me to do a lot of study on the readings, the holy books, and especially the big blue brick that we know of. So I spent a number of years before I ever became like formally involved. And one day there was a Gnostic Mass happening in our local area in Orlando, Florida, and he invited me along. And from then on out, I started coming around. And at the time, that was Secret Center Camp in Orlando. And I shortly thereafter took my Minerval, and I looked into the Outer College and signed up my Student of the Mysteries oath. So I kind of did it almost simultaneously, and that was now 8 years ago. I spent some formative years in my OTO career in Florida, so that's where I got established. When I did my master's degree over in Amsterdam, I spent some time in the Dutch OTO, which is under international, and then I moved over to Portland after completing my studies and spent some time at Sekhet Mot Lodge, and now I'm under UKGL. So I've had some experience being in different bodies, which has given me a really well-rounded experience, I think, of being involved in different OTO groups.
Well, let's talk about your book, One Truth and One Spirit. Can you talk about the origins and how you came to be writing a book like that?
Well, it had a few different stages in evolution. I'd say the genesis of it came from my research at the University of Amsterdam. I did the master's degree studying the Hermetic philosophy, which is primarily in the religious studies. It might have recently moved over into the history department there since I've left. I'm not certain. It was a really good experience. I had a lot of really good background in all of the esoteric traditions from antiquity up to present day. I found my niche in the late modern period and contemporary period because I already had some interest in Crowley. So I decided, I came across some opportunities with letter correspondences and stuff that hadn't really been accessible before. So I found an opportunity to actually do a study on the Thelemic movement and how it developed after Crowley's death in 1947. So the entirety of part two in the book is actually derives originally from my master's thesis at that university. that original thesis is definitely more academic in nature than how the book has evolved now. The book has kind of gone through a sort of series of editorial work that's tried to make it a little bit more accessible for readership. But they'll still find quite a bit of like an academic style to the work. So after I was finished with my studies in Amsterdam, I moved back to the States for a period of time, and I was inspired to write a book under my OTO handle, Frater Teleios, entitled One Truth and One Spirit. And it was a short essay, about 60 pages, kind of addressing the phenomenon that we know as duplexity, which is kind of a new subject, only that's come out over the last few years, I guess, in the Thelemic community. And I wrote about that, and it got quite popular on online. I had only published it online in a PDF format. And over the series of maybe one or 2 years, I came into the opportunity to actually create a book. So I've kind of developed from that short essay, as well as the master's thesis, and I've added quite a bit more to give readers some background as to what Thelema is, who Aleister Crowley is, and how everything is sort of developed up to the point of his death, and then how things developed afterward, with some kind of critical commentary as to where we are up to present day.
So in this book, you go deep into the doctrinal analysis to explore the relationship of the two orders. What is the importance of highlighting these factors?
It's a good question, and it was one that I decided I hadn't done this in the earlier essay and thesis, but I thought, and this is kind of makes up a lot of part one, is sort of giving people background information as to how the OTO developed and the AA developed, and how and Crowley's vision of how these two orders would work together to put forth his movement of Thelema into the world. And I had to go back to the beginning, and basically the idea that I came to was to show people that when you hear the name Aleister Crowley or the Book of the Law, those are the two things you really hear about it. And then people just kind of stop there. But the reality of the situation is that the Book of the Law was the inception of Thelema. But the years that followed, for the next two decades, there is evidence of a sort of revelatory doctrinal progression that kind of happens, and the writings and the workings that follow. So the Book of the Law was received in Cairo in 1904, but only three short years later, Crowley received other inspired writings that we know of as the Holy Books of Thelema. And that this was the same year that he decided to reestablish the Golden Dawn curriculum, the teaching, the magical teaching order that had fallen into schism in 1900, 7 years before. So this was a very important period. And even following that, 2 years after this, was his experiences in the Algerian desert with the vision and the voice, and Victor Neuberg. So this is a very important work that sort of shows a Thelemic system and philosophy and sort of doctrine being kind of developed. It's almost like Thelemic Book of Revelation, so to speak, because it's very apocalyptic in its vision and kind of shows the closing of an old aeon and the beginning of a new. And this is where a lot of our doctrines about Babylon and the beast really kind of come into fruition, was in 1909. And these are just some examples. I can't go into depth on all of them, but basically, I thought that these were very important factors to highlight, because when you get to Crowley's American period in 1915, he's now been involved exclusively with the OTO for 3 years, and has been and has had now 8 years worth of having students in the AA, and he starts to come to the understanding of himself as the prophet in Thelema, and puts both the AA and the OTO in front and center, especially with the publication of the Blue Equinox in 1919. So, and he kind of carries this idea about the OTO and the AA working in unison to promulgate Thelema for the remainder of his life. That's kind of where it got solidified pretty much in 1915 and in the 1920s when he finally became the OHO. So I thought that these were really important, because when he dies in 1947, Thelema almost becomes extinguished, with the interregnum period. And it nearly falls apart, and especially the relationship between the two orders nearly falls apart. And this has only really been attempted at reestablishment since our reconstitution in the 80s and the 1990s. So my reason for doing this was to give the reader some background of where things were, what kind of happened, and where things kind of currently are.
Mm-hmm. In your background work of even being able to discuss what the OTO is, you discuss the ideas of religion and spirituality and how that fits in with the theme of the OTO. But you know, when we say these things, you know, it's a religion and stuff, a lot of people can be, you know, cringe at that thought, you know.
It's a controversial subject, yeah.
However, it was important for you to clarify what that means. Would you like to clarify why you're talking about it as a religion?
I think if we're going to look at it as an object of study, and this isn't necessarily meaning on a philosophical basis or how people believe it to be. But as an object of study, there's a difference when you use the term religion just in normal colloquial language, and how you use it as a term to identify something that you're studying. Whether or not people want to believe it as a religion or not, when you look at it from a sociological standpoint, it would be classified as a religious movement. It involves groups of people that are trying to access sort of meta-empirical like phenomena through a series of ceremonies or rituals, and the activities are very similar to what social theorist on religion would classify it. Now, I do go into some depth about how traditional religion has changed in the landscape, especially since the counterculture movement, and how religion and spirituality, two very elusive terms to even try to define to begin with, change format and become more individualized, individualized expressions of people trying to access these other levels of perception, so to speak. So one thing I tried to do was define, you know, what a spirituality is and what a religion is. And, you know, these are discussions and arguments that can fill the contents of several volumes of books, you know, maybe even make up an entire library and a house. So I had to spend only 10 or 15 pages in doing this, but I did so by using academic work on the study of religion that has looked at sociological interpretations, anthropological interpretations, and so on and so forth, to try to come to some idea of how we can sort of define the OTO and the AA as an object of study. And I came to the conclusion that the OTO, being kind of a social dynamic, expresses kind of what we would say in sociology as religiosity. Mm-hmm. And the AA being much more of an individual sort of path, being classified in spirituality. These are, I do clarify to some degree that these are sort of hard divisions, and there's spiritual elements, of course, and someone's OTO path, and there's religious elements in the AA. So there's a lot of crossover. But it's mostly intended to kind of show the reader of how we can kind of approach this when we look at its history and development. And even Grady McMurtry, when he was trying to reestablish the OTO in the 1960s, he writes to Israel Regardi at some point and says, you know, we have to reestablish this and be recognized as a religious organization if we're going to get anywhere with this. So one of the underlying problems and questions, just a general overall theme in the book, is how a religious movement has to develop, unlike it has in the past, where it has to kind of interact with the secular sphere in order to be legitimized and in order to be recognized by a greater society. So there are certain ways in which it has to express its identity. And in the sense of the OTO, it's become a religious organization. And as a practicing Thelemite, you can contend that it's not religion. And in many ways, it diverges away from any traditional conception of religion. But it's the way that it's sort of had to identify and legitimize itself within a greater social sphere.
And for a point of clarification as well, in order for you to write the book in the first place, you need to
clarify. We have to define terms in order to go forward.
Yeah, I found it was an interesting thing you said with in regards to religion and spirituality, and about wider culture, and that there's while there might be a drop off in people partaking in religion, there's greater amounts of people considering themselves spiritual, and it's which seems to go against the kind of contemporary Western idea that we're not, that we're all into, you know, it's a science-based, you know, factual-based society, but it actually seems to counter that, and there's actually maybe a rise of spirituality in the Western culture on a broader scale.
Yeah, there's been a lot of studies with that, the term that I'm spiritual but not religious is kind of a cliche term. I mean, social theorists still don't even really know what that means, because it's spiritual or spirituality is just as elusive of a term as, if not more, than religion. Mm. So the term, I think, comes from just a reluctance to use a loaded term like religion, because it's got a lot of baggage to it. It places in someone's mind the idea of traditional orthodox religion that's dominated our psyche for so long, and as an oppressive agent for many people in the 20th and 21st century is how we've come to identify it. And with the secularization theory and everything, it makes people want still something to do with something mystical, but not to have anything to do with organized religion, so to speak.
In your book, you quote James Wasserman speaking about the OTO's control of copyright. Mm-hmm. He says, a religious movement has no chance of achieving doctrinal coherence unless it has control of its message. This control and centralization of authority is one of the main points of dispute amongst critics of the OTO. Can you elaborate on this?
First of all, we have to consider Jim's experiences that he recounts in the Center of the Fire. For those listeners who've read that, know that he was literally in the center of everything when the battle for succession was kind of going on between Grady McMurtry and Marcelo Mota. And this was a really interesting, there's so many things that we can kind of break down these events and kind of look at them and analyze them. And one was that, Mota, for all that happened with him kind of losing control after a period of time, he was a worthy opponent to all of this. He was very adamant that Crowley's works should remain in the hands of people who can produce them and publish them without any vitiation to them. So in that point, he had a very good point. There were lots of publications at the time where there were no copyrights for on Crowley, especially in North America, and there were many really great publications, and there were some that were just very sloppy and not missing words out of holy books or commentary that was mixed with Crowley's own commentary. Mm. So an editor's commentary that had no distinction between Crowley's commentary. So there wasn't a lot of scrutiny as to the quality of the work being produced. So in Mota's eyes, it was, there were unauthorized publishers out there producing below standard stuff of Crowley. And he had a good point for addressing that. Now, if you fast forward, it was really important to kind of, to the point of when the OTO and Thelema was going to sort of legitimize itself in secular society, in the greater social sphere, that it needed to secure its heirship to the copyrights, which Crowley left in his will. He left all of his copyrights to the OTO, and that's including the AA materials. And fortunately for us, Carl Germer, although he didn't do much with the OTO in his lifetime, he did secure and consolidate the library and put it in a safe place. So one theme in the book is to show how this library became a single driving force to be able for us to sort of legitimize ourselves into the legal sphere. Now, as far as it being kind of a contention for critics of OTO, I think that the fact that the copyrights were given to the OTO, we have to take care of them. And we still have to make sure that things are produced correctly. There's some works out there that are being reproduced by Crowley now that are very well done. But I've heard even in recent years, you know, recitations recorded of Liber 65, you know, of Class A document being recited incorrectly. Mm. And these are from PDFs that have the wrong words in them. Mm. So, you know, it's a further example of, you know, careless approach to some of the literature that's not put out correctly. So I think it is important that it is safeguarded to some degree by those who would be representatives of Crowley, and to ensure that it's reproduced in the correct format.
Mm, mm. And especially in this day and age where, when it comes to accessibility, we've got an oversaturation of accessibility. I mean, you can type anything into Google and there will be 100 results. So,
yeah, so
I guess it's about a legitimization of official publication.
Yeah, and it's not always presented correctly. Mm. And that's not to say that people can't present it correctly, but there's there is a chance for it not to be, and that's what needs to be eschewed with the securing of copyrights and making sure that things aren't reproduced without in the wrong way, and that goes for our proprietary stuff like our rituals and stuff. They were published in the 1970s by Francis King. Fortunately, not in entirety, but it's important that we keep that stuff so that it's not just liberally reproduced.
One of the surprising revelations in your book is how you point out that Crowley's time, the role and functions of the OHO of the OTO and the Imperator of AA were held by the same person, and how recently we have restored that position.
This is an interesting topic, actually. In Crowley's time, we know that he reestablished the Golden Dawn curriculum as the AA many years before he came to understand himself as authority in the OTO. One thing that I think maybe people don't realize about the AA is that there's no temporal head in the AA, the way that it's structured, to my understanding. It's governed by three officers, and they all govern the order and commensurable balance. They have different distinctive roles, but they all balance one another Crowley held the position of imperator for all his life, and the imperator is one who is sort of the chief executive, the commander-in-chief, the one who governs the order and rules the order and makes secular decisions on its functions. The praemonstrator is the instructing officer who makes sure that teachings of the literature and the curriculum is not corrupted in any sense of the word. And the cancellarius acts as very much a secretary who helps to transmit the rules and teachings of the order to the outer college. Now, the imperator also acts as the first officer in the outer college and directs the outer college in that sense. The OHO is also the executive position of the OTO. So Crowley held both of these offices in his lifetime. And I think I go into it to some degree that he saw some crossover between these positions, although the roles are distinct, as they're two different orders and they're both distinct. But it's clear that through the Paris working, he was able to see some magical and doctrinal crossover to some degree at the major adept grade in the AA, which is where the imperator is stationed, and also in the 9th and 11th degrees of the OTO. And part of me bringing this point into the book is to kind of clarify to the reader that there's not just one person overseeing the functions of how the outer college works, and that there's a balance of power and all of that. And the idea is that since all of the breakdown that kind of happened in the 60s and 70s, when the OTO was reestablished, it took some time, but things got put in place as to how our documents have described the OTO to be reestablished. And the same has been done with the way the AA has been reestablished, with three officers being appointed and functioning much in the same way that it was supposed to in Crowley's lifetime.
For the point of balance, I find that a lot of any conversation I have in regards to Thelema tends to come back to balance. So you explore the dynamics of contemporary online Thelemic discussion. How has the internet changed this for us?
The internet has been a huge evolutionary tool for us as a movement. I go into some degree about how, and I've even used it in the past, when I've done talks at various bodies, we've used Periscope or Skype to kind of put it out to a greater... Yeah, I mean, and we're using it right now. It's a really fascinating phenomenon that we're able to access now. It has benefits and it has a lot of problems as well. But the benefits is that the OTO and just Thelemites in particular are able to reach beyond their local communities now and to engage in discussion. I know that there's and USGL, there's a blog by the Electoral College now, you know, where they have discussions about how to avoid attrition rates and increase membership and all kinds of other really constructive discussions about you know, what's going on in our community. Similarly, you know, even practitioners will meet up on Skype and do rituals or have discussions about the Gnostic Mass or what have you. You know, the Electoral College and some Grand Lodges will meet up for their face-to-face chat, you know. So it's really making it much easier for things to happen in our community and to create a sort of groupthink, or what I call in the book an egregore, so to speak. It's also created some disturbances. I mean, most of us in the Thelemic community kind of know that. And, you know, it's presenting new challenges. And I think it's quite new, so it's going to take some time to know exactly how things are going to pan out and what's going to happen. One thing that I kind of reinforce a few times throughout the book is that within the OTO and the AA, there's a very clear structure in place. In the outer college, one has their superior and one has a student, and that's all you really interact with. But you know there's a chain of command. Similarly, in the OTO, at a local level, you learn that there is a body master and a secretary and a treasurer. There is usually a sovereign grand inspector general. And a bishop, if not in your local area, hopefully somewhere not far away, that can help guide you in EGC matters and also in OTO matters. And, you know, there's an electoral college that has its own process there, and grand lodges, of course, and so on and so forth. So there's a sort of structure set in place that helps the orders to function in the way that they're supposed to. Now, it's a very different thing in the online world. Public pronouncements of authority are can come from any corner of the world, really. And it's a really different thing because it's not so clear. People might not be aware of who these people are, or you know what they're saying, and some are just exchanging ideas and opinions, and it's helpful. It's helpful to have people talking about ideas and Thelemic concepts, but it's also a sort of different thing because the authoritative structure is kind of in a vacuum in which, you know, identity and alterity and power are very fluid dynamics that kind of happen in discussion threads. So one thing I kind of point out when I get to the chapter on the internet is that... these are kind of the differences that we can kind of be aware of, as there is a definite structure in one and a very loose and fluid structure in the other.
It represents again wider culture. I think these are the exact same issues that, you know, any group of people, whoever they may be, face really. It's not necessarily just a Thelemic specified topic at all. It's
It is. Yeah, it's kind of a thing that our entire world is a part of now,
and we're just learning it as well. Very new.
Right. I even point to a couple studies about excessive social media use and stuff like this, but there's still not enough studies out there to really know exactly how it's affecting any individual's psychology on any level.
Mm.
We can only speculate right now.
Mm.
But it's something that I address, and I kind of remind the reader that, you know, it's good to be mindful of, you know, it's always good to have mindfulness of anything, really. But it's, you know, to kind of look at things with critical eyes and kind of know what's kind of going on, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it means we have to be a bit more vigilant, I guess, in our own actions, because it is so easy just to press that button and it's out there for the whole world to see.
it makes it much different. You know, people feel like they have a sort of filter when they're behind the computer screen rather than if they're in the presence of other people.
Yeah, yeah, there's a sense of removal.
Yeah.
You talk about peace, tolerance, and truth as an active method of relating to others in an online context. And I guess we were just talking about this, but can you elaborate more?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer because peace, tolerance, and truth are sort of the, again, three principles here, which happens a lot in both the OTO and the AA. But, you know, these are kind of this is the threefold greeting traditionally put on OTO headings. So it's hard to answer that question for the online context because peace, tolerance, and truth is kind of a beckoning call for that represents a single concept in the OTO, which is that of fraternity and universal brotherhood. You know, this is how universal brotherhood and fraternity are able to function correctly, as through mindfulness of peace, tolerance, and truth. So, enacting these principles in an online context, you'd have to assume that people are OTO initiates, and not everyone is.
Yeah.
Not everyone's been trained in what these are supposed to mean. We learn from the very beginning in our OTO journey that at the very beginning, you know, we're seeking peace, you know. We're seeking after peace and wisdom to know ourselves better and to sort of peel away the parts of us that are undesirable, right?
Mm.
So that's where peace comes from. That my idea of like how I interpret that anyway. These are very large subjects that we can't really tackle in entirety right now.
Mm.
You know, tolerance is something that is important within our bonds because we Thelema is a very individualistic philosophy. Mm. So you're naturally going to have differing opinions all around you. And that's one thing that I think is quite been an interesting revelation for me in my 8 years of OTO is that it's not really conformist in any sense of the term. You know, it's you meet a lot of different kinds of people into different things, and you'll find, just like any diverse group of people, there'll be disagreements and discrepancies that kind of arise. So tolerance is an important factor in this because it allows for people to be who they are. And where tolerance is present, the ego is most absent. And it allows for communication and cooperation and fraternity. And then truth is a very loaded term as well, but I look at it as the principle in which we all sort of strive for under our heading of fraternity. You know, it's the cooperative measures that we take in order to promulgate Thelema, and that's the truth that we all strive to promulgate. So I think within our own bonds, these are important principles, but we can't expect all the online users that are in groups dedicated to Thelemic discussions to fully understand what that means for us as OTO members. But it can be with observance of some of our core materials, you know, such as some of the founding documents of OTO, we can get a glimpse of what that means and how it can possibly be implemented in a greater context, perhaps. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely. I think...
bit long-winded.
No, it's good to expand on these ideas, especially because we are living in such an online world now. And, you know, outside Thelema and in wider society, these are things that we need to be thinking about generally, I think, of how do we act on the internet. It's and yeah, we're very new to it all, so I think, you know, everyone is a little bit confused, you know, in the OG.
Well, we're all experiencing life together, you know.
Yeah.
It's all a journey for us, and you know, that's oftentimes I find one of the main points of struggle is that, you know, when we enter upon the path of initiation, whether we're just solitary practitioners and readers of this material out there and we're trying to find answers and we go online and try to find answers, or, you know, we choose to take membership in OTO or whatever else our interest in Thelema take us, is that once you start engaging in the mental space that occupies, you know, this literature and these practices, it's oftentimes you can't undo that stuff. You've already started going there. And the process of initiation is such that it unravels, you know, our subtle energies and kind of starts to break down everything that we've seemed to know about ourselves since we became incarnate in our existence, right? So the ego will get agitated through the process of initiation, and it will find that it has an inevitable destruction at the end of it, at the end of the process of initiation. So it kicks back and screams, you know, feels like a caged animal or something, perhaps. You know, we're all working on ourselves, and especially when it comes into the group dynamics of the OTO, or in this discussion, the online world, you know, a great deal of people participating are trying to find answers or trying to find things about themselves or trying to, you know, unravel who they are. And, you know, it can create friction, you know, because on top of that, the process of initiation is kind of happening underneath it all.
That's an interesting perspective on it all, actually. Yeah. Well, we need to ask, when is this book being released?
Well, should be going to press sometime next month in September. Pretty sure we're on time for the most part. And according to Amazon, it's available November 1st.
Fantastic.
It is available. It's available by pre-order right now.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to be able to sell a few signed copies directly through the website. Mm-hmm. I don't have information on that yet. I'll have to see how many copies I'm able to get from the publisher from the States and how much it's going to cost to get it over to the UK. And it's kind of my first rodeo with the publication, so I don't know exactly how that's going to affect my ability to sell personal copies. But yeah, it will be available just in time for your Christmas holidays.
The whole farm is getting one.
Yeah.
you just said on the website, could I ask which on Amazon, or is this another website you're talking about, the signed copies?
I've made a homepage for the book, and I actually have started a blog page under that website that kind of is meant to sort of inspire people about the work. And I post some various historical things, you know, that kind of relate to the subject that I treat. And that's at www.one-truth-one-spirit.com.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So anyone listening now knows where to get a signed copy and maybe some more information.
And I have a Facebook page as well for the book as well, so people can like that and see updates.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. You're doing it in a very online way.
Yeah. I think the book is, like we said before, it's a bit dense. It's a heavy read. It's going to cover a lot of ground. It's going to cover a lot of topics. It's going to appear controversial to a few people, some of the topics that I explore there. But I would have to say, just as I said a moment ago, we're all kind of experiencing life together, and life is full of different interpretations, and this one is mine. You know, it's from my perspective and my, I guess, opinions about what's going on and my experience living in the world and within the dynamic of Thelema and the second decade of its second century.
Fantastic.
It's a really exciting time because, you know, there is a lot of accessible things and there are a lot of different perspectives to look at, and you know, there's a lot of groundwork to do as well. I think that's what makes it very interesting, is that we have an opportunity to be active participants in this whole thing, whether someone is ever a formal member of OTO or AA, or, you know, just a solo practitioner. There's so many ways that we can apply Thelema in the world, in our personal lives. It truly is kind of a postmodern spirituality that people are able to apply in their lives.
And exciting as well, I think. It's an exciting time. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. It was really great talking to you, and good luck with your book. I hope a few people will get online and pre-order their copies now.
Thank you. Very much appreciate your time and the opportunity to be on your show.
Thank you. We hope you've enjoyed the show. None of the opinions expressed by hosts or guests reflect the policies of OTO Australia, its members or officers. This is your host, Sora Murr. Love is the law, love under will.